Welcome to Voices of Esalen. I'm Sam Stern. Today, my guest is Stephen Dubner, New York Times bestselling author and host of a very good podcast called Freakonomics. I first met Stephen when he and his crew came to Esalen for an on-site interview focused around deceased Nobel Prize winner and occasional Esalen faculty member Richard Feynman. During the 1980s, in Big Sur, three women who had experience with underground psychedelic therapy, Debbie Harlow, Barbara Berg, and Cheryl Haley, had initiated Feynman through the psychedelic experience. Now the Freakonomics team would interview these three women at Esalen, where they had initially met Feynman. We gathered together in the famed Fritz Room at the southernmost tip of the Esalen property, and brandishing a microphone near my mouth, Stephen asked me the question I had been anticipating, but in some ways had been dreading.
How much do you personally know and care about Richard Feynman?
All I know about Feynman is that there's this one talk in the archive that's from 1984. It's called Tiny Machines. And I listened to it this weekend. It doesn't necessarily feel aligned with the greater human potential movement in general. He seems like a brilliant, neurotic, fast-talking Jewish guy. Doesn't make him unlike the rest of the teachers from that time. His concerns seem scientific and mathematical, not necessarily embodied.
All that is true. Feynman was a superior intellect, a fascinating mind whose work on its surface had little to do with human potential. But as you'll see in this episode, and all the more so if you go to the Freakonomics podcast and dive into their four-part arc on Feynman, as a person, in many ways, he exemplified the Human Potential Project. He pursued expansion and fulfillment right up to the very end of his life. In any case, I am thankful for Feynman, if only because it linked me to Stephen Dubner, one of my favorite writers, thinkers, and interviewers alive today. In our conversation, we delve into the life of Feynman, but save a little time to talk about AI, job loss, storytelling, the future of work, and the critical role of community. In this episode, I'll also play some short clips from one of the recent Freakonomic episodes, Mr. Feynman Takes a Trip But Doesn't Fall. I'll also play a few brief segments from one of Feynman's talks at Esalen Institute in 1984, which he called Tiny Machines. With no further ado, here's my conversation with Stephen Dubner.
Thank you, Sam Stern. I'm almost certainly the least qualified voice of Esalen who's ever graced your ether waves, but I'm going to do my best.
I don't think so. We met at Esalen, so you're doing this episode of Freakonomics, actually a three-part arc on Freakonomics on Richard Feynman. So I thought a great way to bring us into this would be for you to tell us a little bit about this episode that digs into the genius that is Richard Feynman.
Yeah, so this was a three or kind of three-and-a-half-part series. We released one more after the formal three-part arc, and that fourth one was based totally at Esalen. That was a conversation we had with three women who'd attended Esalen a long time ago and had some adventures there with Richard Feynman.
This is Debbie Harlow.
I found that working with psilocybin often opened up doors, so wouldn't it be nice to provide him the opportunity? It was like, pow, tears were pouring down his face. And I could tell he was in ecstasy. He was just laid back and he was bliss, you know, and eventually opened his eyes and he said, oh, Debbie, he said, it's even more beautiful than you promised.
But Richard Feynman himself, for those who don't know or have forgotten, which is to say just about everybody, you know, Feynman was, at one point, not so long ago, just a few decades ago, he died in 1988, was probably the most famous living scientist in the world. His career was kind of marked by two big events. If you like to look at history or lives that way, one near the beginning and one toward the end. The one toward the beginning was his participation in the Manhattan Project, the project at Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build an atomic bomb before the Germans could build theirs. And the chapter toward the end of his life was Feynman serving on a presidential commission to get to the root cause of the disaster of the Challenger space shuttle. But in between, he was a working academic physicist at Caltech, just, you know, 7 or 8 hours down the road from you, and lived a life of what I came to think of as honest inquiry. He was someone who became a scientist because he wanted to understand how the world worked. He happened to become, you know, a leading Nobel laureate theoretical physicist and was known for quantum dynamics and many, many, many other realms that fit just barely sometimes into what we think of as mainstream physics. But he was just a remarkably smart, dynamic, curious. He would have hated to be called a public intellectual. He didn't think of himself as an intellectual, as smart as he was. And he didn't really have much use for the public either, to be honest. It seems like there used to be more people like Feynman in the public intellectual space who could speak truth to power and who could explain complicated things and who could kind of calm us all down and who could make everyone, even politicians, listen. And it feels like the public rhetoric, at least the last few decades, has become more anti-science than that, more shouty than explainy. And so I was driven to focus on Feynman over this Freakonomics Radio series because I think he's worth emulating to some degree. And I wish we had more of that in our society, in academia, in the public sphere now. And Feynman, you know, is someone that I've been reading and reading about for many, many, many years. And I finally got around to it. And so we spent a lot of the last year making this series, including a really amazing stop at Esalen along the way.
Would you bring us into the intersection that Richard Feynman curiously had with the Esalen Institute?
So he, I guess you'd call him a frequent guest and occasional lecturer, okay? Mm-hmm. He did give a few talks there. He enjoyed, you know, I think he enjoyed all aspects of it. And the main event that we focus on in the series, because it was unknown even to Feynman aficionados, was a period toward the end of his life when he did some LSD and psilocybin mushroom experimentation with these three women I mentioned earlier, whom he called the Three Graces after the daughters of Zeus. They were just really smart, clinically minded, young professionals who had been experimenting with psychedelics for different treatments of therapy. This was in the early to mid-1980s. And Feynman intersected with them just at Esalen, and then the drug experimentation became the next move for him and them.
This is Barbara Berg.
I remember recalling one of the LSD session. I thought it was so funny. He was lying on the same couch staring at a banana for 3 hours, quiet as could be. Debbie had trained him well. He would just turn it once in a while. And afterwards, I asked him what was happening. And he said, very sincerely, said, I don't know. I was just looking at the banana.
He had always been, his entire life, since he was a young kid, he'd always been interested in, I guess you'd call it consciousness, but it's more than that, different layers, different intersections, the conscious and the unconscious. He was always an experimenter, always trying stuff out, blowing stuff up, lighting things on fire, and so on. He loved to literally just ask the question of why does this thing do that?
This is Richard Feynman from a talk that he gave at Esalen in 1984 entitled Tiny Machines.
We've been talking about personal problems and thinking about personal problems. They said we got enough of that stuff in all the other workshops and all the other things at Esalen. Could you talk about something else? So I'm talking about something entirely impersonal that involves nobody and no problems.
Feynman, from an early age, was a skeptic. I wouldn't say a cynic at all, but he learned to be skeptical of outward signs. He learned to be skeptical of people who thought they understood something because they knew what its name was.
All right, now it turns out if you take all the books in all the libraries, Turkish, Hungarian, everything, all over the entire world, then all this goes into a volume of material, 1/200th of an inch on a side, which is the smallest piece of dust that you can possibly see.
Even after he'd won his Nobel Prize, he was not a very two-way street academic. He didn't want to read anybody else's stuff, really. He was an original thinker, and sometimes that was redundant, repetitive, but that's the way he thought about the world. And so he was very curious about what humans are, not so much how they came to be, but how they operate. And he built, in his mind, this was not a professional thing, really. This was more on the side, but he built his own kind of, you know, operation manual for the human being. And a lot of that was the connection between, you know, what's going on in the brain. And so from the time he was a little kid, he was very, very, very interested in all claims of mind power, everything from meditation to ESP and so on. And he thought most of it was total garbage. He thought that the mind was an absolutely amazing set of muscles or whatever they are, that because it's so powerful at times and because it's so mysterious, there was also a lot of opportunity for charlatans to come along and pitch stories about it. And so he was, in that regard, again, a good, healthy, skeptical scientist.
We need tiny tools to push things around. Oh, as a matter of fact, if you went to the full limit, we wouldn't need chemists anymore. All that a chemist does is rearrange, make a new molecule with a different arrangement of atoms. So if you went down to a smaller enough scale, you just put the atoms down where you want them to make the molecule. No hocus pocus with bottles and colored liquids.
He was really interested in exploring the reality of his own mind, as one of the three graces that we spoke with at Esalen put it to us, as he was at exploring the reality of the natural universe. Now, the problem was that he didn't want to do drugs throughout most of his life because he didn't know what it would lead to in his brain. And his brain was not just his favorite toy, but his most powerful tool. Toward the end of his life, however, he suffered from cancer for quite a few years. It took a long time to kill him, but finally it did. But toward the end, when he knew that he didn't have much time, he finally changed his position on that. And so when one of these three graces at Esalen offered him the opportunity to do these drugs, he took it.
This is Cheryl Haley.
What I remember that I thought was quite significant was when Richard was getting off on LSD for the first time, we were watching the water and the water was moving, and he started saying, "We've got to draw the line somewhere. We've got to draw the line somewhere."
Kind of a process-based question here. I had the privilege of shadowing you throughout the day at Esalen. And while you were there, I mean, I felt like I picked up so much on the way that you approach storytelling and opening up a story. And initially, I had this thought that you could have done this piece on Feynman without ever actually coming to Esalen. You could have conducted your interviews, you know, over Zoom. And in fact, to come to Esalen and bring a crew there kind of flies in the face of contemporary digital journalism. It's almost like it's like a nod to Gonzo days, to the days of Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson, when they had to be present in order to report their stories. What is it about going that extra mile that helps you create your story in your Freakonomics mode?
Well, that was out of the ordinary, even for us. So we do try to get out of the studio when we can, but you know, we're a weekly podcast and NPR show, which
right.
So it's extremely labor intensive to put out any new show in a given week. Once you start going to record remotely, which is much, much, much less efficient, just from a time perspective, obviously, it really changes the character of what you're making. So in a perfect world, or in a different world, you know, I might make 10 episodes a year, which would be a little bit more like writing a book as opposed to writing, you know, a weekly magazine column. But the fact is, I mean, that's what I used to do. I used to write books. And, you know, sometimes I wouldn't see anyone for 3 years. And I didn't love that.
Right.
I will say there are advantages of recording in the field and there are disadvantages. Mm. The disadvantages are essentially that the tape just doesn't sound as good as a studio. And that's and there are, within that even, there are many pros and cons to how field tape sounds different. Some of it is better, but, you know, for a radio-ready show, it can be really difficult to get great audio when you're out in the field. I really like recording interviews remotely. So long before COVID happened, I was a remote worker, and I had been for years, even doing radio. So just having a studio wherever I've lived, I've just always built a little studio of some kind. And partly that's because, I mean, it's mostly because I like spending time alone. I mean, I became a writer in part because, you know, I don't mean to compare myself to Feynman, but yeah, that's what I like to do. I like to try to figure out how the world works. And sometimes you need to go out into the world to do that. But then you need to gather as much information as you can and do as much thinking and writing as you can on that. And a lot of that is solitary work. And I love that. I mean, I like, if I'm alone all day for 10, 12 hours, I'm happy to see my family and friends after that. But there's something incredibly, maybe medicinal, certainly fun, challenging about doing that kind of, spending that time alone. And then for recording audio, which is what we do for our podcast and radio show, being remote, being separate from the other person in the studio does provide just like some small practical advantages. Like if we're not in the same room and our mics are on different tracks in different studios, then that tape can be edited really cleanly however we need it to be. Mm. And I'm a bad interrupter. So if I'm interviewing someone for a couple hours, I'm constantly, you know, just, you mean blah, blah, like horrible. It sounds terrible when you listen to that, but we mute me and then everything is good. So as you may have observed when we were at the Fritz cabin at Esalen, me speaking with these three women, Debbie, Cheryl, and Barbara, mm-hmm. you know, I had to like basically hold my hand over my mouth to shut up. It's just not in my nature.
Let's pivot a little bit. I want to ask you about future thoughts, given sort of the evolving nature of work as we blend the advancements in AI and technology. How do you foresee the future of work shaping up, perhaps over the next year or two only?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It is a question I certainly think about all the time. I think we've actually done probably maybe 3 to 4 episodes of Freakonomics Radio related to that topic over the past maybe 8 or 10 years now, long before we had LLM, large language models that are feeding things like ChatGPT, which has plainly caught the world's attention. I mean, that's been an amazing development just to see how many people suddenly care about, good in good ways and bad, this new technology. But, you know, this has been a problem if you're an economist or an economic historian. This has been a problem or an issue, at least, that you've looked at, not just in the last 10 years, but in the last, you know, couple hundred years. The Industrial Revolution changed things at a scale that had never been seen before. And, you know, the automation and technology of the last 30, 40, 50 years, the digital revolution has again changed an awful lot of things at a fast rate. And now we're concerned about another wave that seems like it may be different. There is, you know, there are many think pieces about this topic that are titled some version of this time it really is different. Mm. Whenever you see that caution, you think, well, if you have to say this time it really will be, there's a good chance it won't be. Mm. I will say this: humans are really bad at predicting the future. Full stop. The more history you read, the more evidence you have for this. That doesn't mean that things don't change and change fast. Sometimes they do. Usually they change slowly, but sometimes they change fast. The classic cautionary tale story is the buggy whip manufacturers from when there were horses and carriages that went out of business. What did those poor people do? Did they end up in the gutter, you know, drinking cheap whiskey? And the economist always likes to say, no, that's not the way it happens. That's what makes an economy like ours function, is it's dynamic. It changes. The inputs, when the outputs change, the inputs can change and vice versa. You know, with the computer era, again, people, if you look back 40, 50 years and think of computers generally as the way people are thinking about and scared of AI now, you could say, well, there are so many things that computers will be able to do that, of course, humans won't need to be able to do those. And therefore, those humans will be put out of work. And as we've seen, that didn't happen because the computer, aside from being a labor saver, is also a tool that has a million versions that create a million more opportunities. So you and I are able to have this conversation in real time, sounding good because of all the things that come with digital audio and computing generally. Mm-hmm. So you create industries like podcasting, although that's not really quite fair because radio existed and this is just a digital version thereof. But anyway, that happens over and over and over and over again. Every economic historian that writes about history, that's essentially a description of what happens. But you also have to realize that, like I said, people are bad at predictions, even really smart people. So if you look at what happened in this country with manufacturing jobs over the past, let's call it 35 or 40 years, the big argument for the U.S. was, let's get China into the World Trade Organization. Let's make our economy more global. Let's consider ourselves true modernists in the sense that it doesn't matter if a given thing or process, if a car or whatever takes 10 different inputs to happen in different places, and the inputs are bought with money, and the output is then bought with money. Money is so fungible that it doesn't matter where those things are done as long as people are getting paid the right price for it. And so if we're an American car company, or if an American company of some kind, textiles, let's say, and I want to manufacture my product, design it in you know, Concord, North Carolina, manufacture it in China, then ship it back to New York to sell in the U.S., that's all going to work out. So that was the story that economists liked to tell, and politicians, about, you know, the new age of economic globalism that's coming, or distributed labor like that. And part of their argument was that the people that, you know, let's say the hundreds of thousands or millions of people who may lose manufacturing jobs in the U.S. will instead have opportunities that are better than those. They'll be retrained. They'll do, you know, data entry. They'll do design, whatever. They could do all these different things. As it turns out, a prediction like that often misses the fact that humans are not as predictable as we'd like them to be. A lot of people didn't retrain. And also, there are frictions in the world. Like, if I live in a given place, and most of the employment opportunity in that given place is a textile mill or a coal mine, then where am I supposed to go to this training center now? And how am I supposed to get this new job that's supposed to pay 20% more? And instead, I end up with less. So that was a case where technology and labor intersected to form a kind of imperfect storm in this country for the purposes of employment and so on. And people were wrong about it. I say that only to emphasize the fact that predicting is hard. And when you're trying to predict something as complicated as how are millions and billions of people going to respond to different labor incentives and financial incentives and digital and technological incentives in the future, it's really hard to say. When it comes to AI, why should it necessarily be different than past technologies? To me, that answer is not obvious. Some people, however, do believe that AI, by the nature of what it is or is trying to be, will have a higher replacement rate than anything has in the past. And if that's the case, then you've got a new set of issues. I wouldn't even call them problems. I mean, I think there are a lot of people, you know, most people in the world hate their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I happen to like mine a lot. I'm guessing you do too.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
We're in the minority.
Yeah.
So you have to realize most people work every day to make money to eat and feed their to take care of their families. That is, and they're doing something that they dislike, the vast majority of people. So this idea that more and more of the labor that most of us do not want to do can be done in a different fashion and therefore alleviate that need, I don't see how that's prima facie a terrible thing. Now, that kind of gets into the whole Calvinist argument that you need to work for your satisfaction and for your fulfillment and to feel like you're contributing. But, you know, there are a lot of things we can all do to help ourselves and help each other that are not about working for a company that will, you know, basically exchange your labor for income that you can use to buy food. If all those things are taken care of, that might open up possibilities that would be, you know, truly wonderful. The short answer is we don't know. So, you know, journalism is the first draft of history, they say. I think sometimes it's like the roughest version of the first draft, but if I'm trying to channel Feynman here, I think, man, what an amazing moment in history to be living through.
All right, now let's see what we would have to do if we wanted to write the entire Encyclopedia Britannica on the head of a pin. Can we do that? The Encyclopedia Britannica has something 20, 30, some odd thousand pages. And you imagine that each page is on a special piece of paper and you put them all over the ground. And you get a great big area, you know, 20,000 square feet. And that has to be shrunk down to the size of a head of a pin. So if we could reduce the size of the words, the letters, the dots in the pictures, the whole thing, everything that's in the encyclopedia, only by 20,000 times this way, then we could write the entire encyclopedia on a head of a pin.
Just try to look at it as closely as you can, observe it, be curious about every element of it, ask questions. You know, it's really fun in a topic like this when someone is very, very sure of themselves. I love to just ask questions, just ask them to explain. This would be like what Feynman would do. Explain, wait, that connects to that how and why. Like he would ask questions he knew the answers to. There's this thing called, that psychologists call the illusion of explanatory depth. And it means that most of us think that we can explain things much better than we can. This really goes again to the kinds of, it's not even a misunderstanding that Feynman hated. It's a deceit. It's a form of cheating to pretend you know more. So these psychologists would do these neat studies where they would identify a hot button topic, gun control or whatnot, and they'd have people state their positions. And then they would run them through this different exercise that had nothing to do with the topic, like a zipper. They'd say, do you know what a zipper is, right? Yeah. Do you know how a zipper works? Yeah. All right, explain to me how a zipper works. Or they do it with like a ballpoint pen or a toilet. And all of a sudden, most people, they can't really explain. They know what it is. Mm. Like Feynman would say, they know the name of the thing, but they don't really know how it works or what it is exactly. And then after those people are made to understand that they may not understand something even as simple as a zipper so well, then you go back to the hot topic, the gun control or nuclear power, whatever it is, and you find that people are much more humble about their opinions. Mm. So this is where, you know, this is where I see the depth and amount of training we should all be doing for ourselves to all be more aware of our limitations and our abilities. I think, you know, I think we're a wonderful species, but we should recognize our limitations.
Thank you for that. I like that a lot. I got a lot out of that. What has, if any, been your engagement with generative AI with regards to your storytelling process, with regards to your production? Has it affected in any way you as a kind of working artist, writer, producer?
I mean, I love using ChatGPT. I love using Perplexity.ai. Perplexity calls itself an answer engine as opposed to Google, which is a search engine. Mm. I've loved Google for many years, but we actually made an episode called, I think it was called, Is Google Getting Worse? Although that sounds kind of lightweight now. I think we should have called it, Has Google Become Terrible? Because if you're old enough to have been around in the beginning of, you know, search and the web, Google was the biggest magic wand ever. Like as a writer, it was just hard to communicate how wonderful it was. Then my experience, at least, and everybody's differs, is that it's become much, I'll just say it, worse over time, because it is, while it is really good at identifying links or sites or sometimes Google's own material that is connected to, let's say, buying something or doing something, you know, something commercial, it's become less effective for me as a research tool. So ChatGPT has plenty of imperfections, but it's got a lot of benefit as not just a search or answer engine, but as an explainer. Perplexity AI, which I've only just begun playing with recently, I would say even more so. It's more conversational. It's really fast, and it identifies its sources, which ChatGPT is only, as far as I can tell, just starting to do in some cases. And as a journalist, you do want to know the sourcing because, you know, these engines do have the ability to, the word they use is hallucinate. They have the ability to make up, to kind of get to a different state of thinking and make up facts, which you don't really want in a search or answer engine. So I look at these tools as being really useful. That said, I think there are all kinds of issues to consider. I used to work at the New York Times. These large language models will use databases like the New York Times to train themselves to become sentient-seeming beings. And you have to ask, what does that mean for the people who've created that content? Are they being remunerated for their labor? And as far as I know, at this moment, at least, certainly no. But I think even the even bigger question is, if in the future, anything that's created by anybody in just about any public or quasi-public format is made available as raw data on which to train and then use a computer to be a much better version of that initial creator, then where do the incentives go for creators? Maybe that's an issue, maybe it's not. We don't really know. We've seen this in pop culture over and over again. You know, the video was supposed to kill the movie, which it didn't, in part because it expanded the culture of movie consumption. the other hand, the streaming and studio chapters of the entertainment world are having a lot of glitches too. So, you know, there's always disruption. You can get depressed by it. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes bad things truly happen to good people. But again, if you look at it with a little bit of the Feynman view or a little bit of the view of like a Joseph Schumpeter, who is, a Viennese economist who coined the phrase creative destruction to talk about what happens when an economy works, you know, things are being broken to create new things. And the world is endlessly fascinating.
Yes.
If you're willing to engage with it. And if you have teachers who teach you how to engage, and for me, that's what Feynman was. He was a fantastic teacher. I never met him, but he taught me a great, great, great deal. And so, you know, I'm grateful that there are people like that in the world.
What's your point of view? I mean, having written a couple of best-selling books, I mean, they're predicated around being incisive. They're predicated around a certain mode of thinking, a way to examine topics in a sort of a useful slash new way. What do you think about the process of them being sucked up into a data set in order to feed a large language model and probably improve that large language model, probably imbue it in a certain sense with some of your perspective?
Yeah, no, right on. No, that's a great question. In fact, I will tell you, I think it was yesterday, I did interview the CEO of one of these answer engines, Perplexity, and I asked him a version of that question because, you know, because he was talking about, you know, he made a statement about the quality of their search returns, of their answer returns, let's call them, as being very writerly. He was trying to say why Perplexity is better than ChatGPT, which, you know, whatever, that's his job to say that. He's the CEO of one.
Yeah.
And he was saying, you know, our answers are they're well-written. And I said, well, no offense to you, I don't think they're well-written. I think they're, you know, they're English, they're coherent, cogent English, but they're nothing I would call well-written. He said, okay, if that's the case, you should know that it will get better and better because it's going to keep imitating the better writers. So that definitely, Sam, I mean, that definitely got my attention to say, whoa, okay, wait a minute now. does this mean that good writing, and look, I happen to be a person who cares a great deal about writing. Writing is something I've always loved. I've always loved doing, you know, reading obviously as well. I've been a writer since I was a kid. We had a family newspaper. My dad was a newspaper man. I started my school newspaper. It was what I wanted to be really from the time I was a kid, in addition to a couple other things that I tried out first. And so to me, writing is, it's as complicated as a religion is. It's got all these different beliefs and elements and so on. And so the idea that writing itself could be subsumed or vacuumed up, as you said, by a computer and chewed up and spat out into a canonical version that's high enough quality that nobody would ever really care about voice or anything like that. Yeah, that depresses me a little bit. But I'm also not at all sure that that's actually going to be the case, right? I mean, I do think one mistake many of us make when we think about technology generally is that some piece of technology comes into our lives and becomes the 100% use case for everybody. And that's almost never the case. You know, one of the closest cases is Google. Google is like between 85 and 90% dominant in the search market. So, but you know, just because I'm using chat, GPT or Perplexity or Google to try to expand the set of ideas that I want to think about when I'm trying to tell a story, you know, I look at them as tools and I want to have the best tools I can have. So will they be a replacement for some people in some areas? Absolutely. But, you know, I'm guessing and hoping that's not the complete story. If you look at the introduction of any technology, any technology that becomes ultimately successful, it's always fought against tooth and nail by a pretty significant part of the population often. You know, electricity was incredibly scary and controversial. You know, I remember reading, was it David McCullough who wrote all those good history books, one about the Brooklyn Bridge, when the Manhattan side span went up and was available for the public, they let people walk on it, you know, up, I guess it was up the roadway, up the ramp. And many of them, and all of a sudden they're standing here at a height of what might be, I don't know, maybe what we would think of today in maybe as an 8 or 10 story building, maybe something like that height. But this was pre-elevator. And so the tallest buildings around that area were, you know, 4 or 5 story tenements. And so some people, according to my memory of this book, both of which might be wrong, I should say, these people would get up onto this span and look down on the rooftops of their buildings and like pass out. It was too much. So if we think about that today, we think, oh my goodness, how naive, how silly. But the fact is that the human mind is a great learner in the realms where it can gain comfort and traction. But anytime you shift that traction or make it a little uncomfortable, we get a little bit wiggy. And that's what happens with new technology all the time. So, you know, I take comfort in reading economic history like that because it calms me down a little bit in the now.
Yeah, another piece of the whole new technology puzzle is that in certain ways it's advantageous because it separates out what is truly human, what cannot be farmed out. In doing so, I think about a place like Esalen where its reason for being is to tap into this essentialized human, into the body, into the somatic experience, we're into relaxation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the only other thing I'd add to that is, and I say this as someone who really likes being alone, Sam, like it's great to connect with other people. And modern society, probably older society too, throws up a lot of barriers to human connection. You know, there's status and class, there's fear of others. There are all kinds of ways in which we are often not encouraged or incentivized to really connect deeply with other people. And then when you can do that, whether it's a loved one or someone you just met or someone you're getting together with in a place like an Esalen to explore a common set of ideas and questions, and then you make those human connections, I haven't found anything to replace that. That may come, I don't know, but I certainly haven't found anything to replace that yet. And honestly, that was kind of the story of Feynman and these three graces at Esalen. One thing that they felt very strongly was that he was the kind of person who was able to connect deeply with another person that he just met because he was, I guess, you know, we use the phrase open-minded all the time. I think the minute most of us use that phrase, we're actually saying the opposite. It's like, come on, be open-minded. Change your mind to what I'm saying. But I think he was someone who truly was open-minded and open-hearted. And he liked the human connection, I think, because he recognized its power. You know, just having an opportunity to tell 2 minutes of your story to someone can be a really powerful connector. And yeah, I don't think there's a chatbot yet that can do that.
Stephen Dubner, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so fun to talk with you and pick your brain. Thank you.
Yeah, Sam, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Voices of Esalen. Today's show is produced in conjunction with Shira Levine. Our theme music was composed by Nico Holloman. All additional music was created by me, using an AI program, Suno. Thanks to Freakonomics for allowing us to use small portions of their episode, Mr. Feynman Takes a Trip But Doesn't Fall. The three graces are Debbie Harlow, Barbara Berg, and Cheryl Haley. Until next time, be well and be kind.